For those who weren't here last week, we've been talking about the history of the church. Last week, we got into the second century, so we finished up on the apostles and some of their work and began talking about the apostasy in the beginning of the second century. So I got a couple questions to start with just to jog your memory. What did I say was the first change in the government of the church that we saw at the beginning of the second century and even probably just a little bit before then?
Church government.
So what was the main issue that we brought up and talked about last week? What was the government issue that changed?
The different levels of the elders.
Okay. So start off, and there was elders in every congregation as the apostles had appointed them by the evangelist. And then we found that in matters where there needed to be a decision, that sometimes there were councils. In the early church, in the first century, it was acceptable. They went to Jerusalem. In 50 AD, they had the Council of Jerusalem, where they sought the opinion of the elders or the apostles in Jerusalem. That was a good thing, because they were wholly inspired men of God. But after the second century began, and those apostles were no longer around, should the churches have been going to other churches to make their decisions and looking to other elders? No. It shouldn't have been happening. What should they have used as their authority? The Bible. Now, it was still being put together at that time, but they still had many of the writings of the early apostles.
It was in the really early formation, but actually what was would follow just a little bit later. They were trying to have a succession of apostles.
Okay. That's a good way to put it, Dwayne. A succession of apostles. So the rural congregations oftentimes went to the larger congregations. What were the elders called in some of the larger congregations in the larger cities, in the urban areas?
If they're singled out, the bishop.
They divided the bishop and the presbyter and the elder and made two different offices. In the larger congregations, they were often called the metropolitans. And in the most influential religious cities of the day, Alexandria, Antioch, Jerusalem, eventually Constantinople, and Rome, there were the patriarchs, as they were called by the Catholic Church. We talked a little bit about this Apostles' Creed. At first, we find first notice of it in 190 A.D., and I read it to you last week. I was doing a little bit of studying on it just to see what denominations still use the Apostles' Creed. The Apostles' Creed, here's the 190 version. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, and in Jesus Christ, His Son, who was born of Mary, the Virgin, was crucified by Pontius Pilate and buried. On the third day, arose from the dead, ascended to heaven, sitteth on the right hand of the Father, from whence He cometh to judge the quick and the dead, and in the Holy Ghost and the resurrection of the body. Those things in and of themselves are biblical things. We believe in those things as well, but is there a need to set up a creed of those things? A man-made established creed for those things? No, those things are already in the Scripture. So as I was looking around to see what other denominations used some type of a creed, there are a lot of them. So obviously the Roman Catholic Church has the Apostles' Creed is a pretty succinct part of their worship service. It's been changed 16 times since it was initially written. This was one that's in the Universal Methodist Hymnal. They have a single hymnal that they all use. And I actually talked to a Methodist lady last night who's a friend of mine and asked her about it. I said, is it in your hymnal? Do you guys read it? Do you sing it? What do you do? She said that about once a month, they'll always recite it out of their songbook. So you can see it's changed. And the Methodist Church, you'll see by in the last stanza there, the Holy Catholic Church. They want to make sure that everybody knows it's not the Roman Catholic Church, it's the Universal Catholic Church. So you can see there's been several changes in there. Not tremendous, but important changes. I thought I'd bring that up. There's a traditional on page 881, and there's also an ecumenical version on page 883. Okay. Any other questions about that Apostles' Creed?
I think you mentioned it earlier, but I think it bears mentioning it again. You know, know, if this was something that originated from the apostles and something that originated from God, it would not need to be changed. God's laws are universal, and they apply from the first century all the way to today. So if it was something that came from God, it wouldn't need to be changed.
Many of the Orthodox Catholics believe that the Apostles' Creed, that there are 12 individual recitations within it, and that each of the apostles had one of those things, or they attribute it to each one of the one apostles. And many times it's reviewed and studied and has to be committed to memory for confirmation in several religious bodies. Tad?
Another thing worth mentioning is the first two things that you've mentioned as far as the apostasy of the church, you know, on the surface may not seem like that big of a deal. You know, how big of a deal is it for churches to put a creed together that represents the foundations of their belief? You know, someone might say, well, how big of a deal is it really to, you know, for one church to consult the leadership of another church? And in the beginning, maybe it wasn't that big of a deal, but we can't judge things in that way. We can judge it, though, based on the effect that it had, because the effect that it had, as, you know, as more bureaucracy was created inside of the church, power in the church became more centralized and more centralized and more centralized, until in the end there was one person appointed as the authority in the church, and one church and one person who was responsible for establishing the creeds and doctrines of the church. And so, and that's just the nature of apostasy. It starts out maybe seemingly simple and inconsequential, but if you follow that path, you know, this is how it ends up, with centralized power and, you know, creeds that don't even reflect the Bible anymore.
It was something that didn't happen overnight. I completely agree with Tad's statement there, that it was something that took off, and I think that it caught fire and took hold and grew extremely quickly when, as we're going to study today, Constantine became the emperor, and shortly thereafter with Theodosius as well, it became the religion of the state, the religion of the empire. And so there was a lot of power associated with that leadership, and men who wanted that power abused that position. So we've got Origen in 220. This man was from Alexandria, Egypt. And there were quite a few churches down south in Egypt, as well as there were out in Gaul, in Britannia, as well as Spain, out the far west. But Origen was down in Alexandria, Egypt, was studied under, I'm drawing a blank now. I can't think now. There was another man that had started a congregation down there, a school, and he attended that school as well. But he was one that believed in infant baptism. He also believed that Christ was a created being. He thought that Christ was similar to the angels and was created. And that in the beginning, and we talked about this in some of our other classes, that there were some angels that remained pure and holy, which are still angels today, in his opinion. And there were those other angels that did not want to follow the Lord, and those became demons. And he said that the best of the best of those created angels was Christ, or the Logos. We know that that's not accurate, but that was his thoughts and opinions about Christ. And that really took hold. There was another man named Arius that adopted that belief in Christ being subject and much more of a created figure below the Father. We talked about sprinkling last week. Does anybody remember your trivia question? Who is the first man that was sprinkled rather than baptized or immersed? A man on his deathbed. It was Novatian, was his name. And it was often called the baptism of the sick, for those folks that could not be immersed or could not get to the water. That wasn't widely accepted by churches in the very beginning. It wasn't until about the 8th century that took hold. The last thing that we've got in recap, and it's a little bit of new information, was the synod, which is the same thing as a council. Council is a little bit more of a generic, broader term. But a synod of Elvira, which was in, I don't know if it's Granada or Grenada, Spain. This was in 303. This was a significant gathering of elders, bishops, presbyters from all over the known world to come to Spain to talk about and make decisions on matters in the church, particularly discipline. And I want to read a few of these to you because they blew me away. I didn't know that they were this old. This is 303 A.D. One of the things that they did in this council was oppose the painting of religious subjects on the walls of church buildings. Now, this didn't come from the Christian converts. This came from the pagans who were converted to Christianity. They were used to the statues. They were used to the paintings of all these things. And they thought it would be acceptable to adorn the inside of their churches with these paintings. This council opposed that. This was also the council that prohibited the marriage of the clergy. I'll read a little bit here. The canons which are available in English and Latin online are almost entirely concerned with the conduct of various elements of the Christian community and have no theological content as such. Sanctions include long delays before baptism, exclusion from the Eucharist for periods of months or years, or indefinitely, sometimes with an exception of for the deathbed, though this is specifically excluded in some cases. Periods of penance for sexual offenses extended 5 to 10 years. Canon 5. If a woman beats her servant and causes death within 3 days, she shall undergo 7 years penance if the injury was inflicted on purpose for 5 years, if it was accidental. She shall not receive communion during this penance unless she becomes ill. If so, she may receive communion. Where did that come from? Is that in the scriptures anywhere? No. Canon 15 prohibited the marriage with pagans. Canon 16 prohibited marriage of Christians with Jews. Canon 78 threatened Christians who committed adultery with Jews with ostracism. Canon 48 forbade the blessing of Christian crops by Jews. Canon 50 forbade the sharing of meals by Christians and Jews. Among the later canons of a special note are Canon 33, enjoining celibacy upon all clerics, married or not, and who minister at the altar. It was Canon 36 that talked about the images. It said, pictures are not to be placed in the churches so that they do not become objects of worship and adoration. I would agree with that. It allegedly forbids pictures in the churches, according to Philip Schaff, this canon. Canon 38 permits lay baptism under certain conditions. And 53 forbids one bishop restoring a person excommunicated by another. And the list goes on and on. It's unreal. Like this one. 67, a woman who is baptized must not associate with hairdressers or men with long hair. I thought these were comical, funny, that they came up with these things, but this is what they were deciding at that time. These are unbiblical things. Many of them are. I think of passages that we have in the New Testament about the Spirit says expressly that in latter times men will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits, forbidding to marry, commanding to abstain from foods which God created clean, having their conscience seared with a hot iron. You know, passages like that come to my mind. So this was in 303, the Council of Elvira. What else happened in 303 was Diocletian. So there was a period of about 40 years of peace in the Roman Empire. There were some good empires, but then we have some bad ones starting up again, beginning with Diocletian. Diocletian was actually a slave, but he was a very intelligent man. And if you can imagine the transition of a slave to the emperor of Rome, think of how crafty he must have been. And once he got into power, he decided he wanted to have some strong allies. So the first person that he chose to align with himself was Maximin, who was a general, a very able general. He's the guy with the funny eyebrows, second from left. So it's Diocletian on the far left, Maximin, Galerius, and Constantius, or I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Karen, Emily, Lana, want to help me out here? I've always been calling him Constantius in my head. I wouldn't know what the exact Greek pronunciation is. But these were the men he chose. So Maximin was his co-emperor. And then several, about 5 years later, he chose some junior Caesars to manage some of the farther areas. In the west was Galerius, and the very far north was Constantius, who had Gaul and Britannia. So they were in charge of the far reaches of the empire. These four men ruled together. Constantius didn't really like Christianity, but he didn't severely persecute it. The worst was Galerius. He had an edict of Milan and several others where he ordered the burning of many Christians. Burning of many Christians alive. Their request was that they had to offer sacrifices to the Roman gods. And if they wouldn't do that, they were either thrown in prison or they were burned. The prisons became so full that they had to release almost all of the normal incarcerated folks who had stolen something or killed somebody else. They had to release those people because the prisons became so full with Christians. So Galerius was the absolute worst. Constantius was the best of the worst. And it was his son, Constantine, who was the one that really advocated Christianity. He lived it outwardly, but not inwardly, as the emperor. He was married to a woman named Helena. And she was actually a Christian, which was quite interesting to have an emperor married to a Christian woman. And that's most likely where Constantine got his influence for Christianity as he was growing up. During this period, beginning at 303, it was titled the Great Persecution by historians. It was the last and most severe persecution against the Christians. All the sacred scriptures and writings were ordered to be burned. Church leadership was ordered to sacrifice to the gods. And then finally, Constantine, at the death of his father, became the co-emperor in Gaul and Britannia. So once he became emperor, he took out Maximin and he took out Galerius because he wanted to be the sole emperor. After he took out Maximin in a decisive battle in 308, he turned to his son because he didn't want his son to rise to power. And of course, his name was Maxentius. And that was a very significant battle. So we're talking about the son of Maximin and the son of Constantius. And this took place at Milvain Bridge, which is just outside of Rome. And this was in 312. There was an actual date. I don't know if I got it written down. I think it was like October 23rd, 312. So Maximin decided, I'm going to be the sole emperor. I'm going to march to Rome, and everybody's going to follow me. And there was a significant battle between Maxentius and Constantine. And it's recorded by Eusebius and several others that the night before he went into battle, he had a vision before he went to bed. And also that evening, he looked up in the sky and he saw the sign of the cross in the clouds. And he swore an oath to those around him that said, if I'm victorious at the Battle of Milvain, then I will become a Christian. It took him to the age of 40 to actually become a Christian, in his terms. But this was his vexillum, or also his labrum, which was the standard that they carried into battle. I'm going to draw it a little bit smaller here. So you see him carrying around this pole, and they usually have the sign of the emperor. He had three red dots, and on the top there was some fringe. And up here was this symbol like this. And that's what they carried around. This was the vexillum of Constantine. Anybody know what the symbol is above that?
P and an X.
P and an X. Okay. So if you know some of the Greek alphabet, it's the first two letters in the name of Christ in the Greek, Chi and Rho. Chi and Rho put together. So although it's not quite the common symbol we think of in our mind as the cross, that's what they used for the cross, at least in Constantine. And this was a very popular image by Constantine. And don't forget, he came out of Rome, so this was a very pagan area. You'll notice it up in the top right, the standard that they carried into battle. So as he was fighting, they basically destroyed Maxentius' army, and he fled, and the bridge was so crowded that he couldn't get through, that he tried to go through the water, and because of all of his heavy armor, he drowned. They found his body a day later, and they carried it into the city. They burned his body, and they paraded his head around Rome. So that's how Constantine decided that he wanted to show everybody that he was the new emperor. This was a coin that was struck in his honor. Some of the buildings. The one on the top left is Old St. Peter's Basilica. Who knows where that's located at? Or used to be the ruins located at? The spot of the new St. Peter's Basilica. And where's that at today?
Rome.
It's in Rome. It's in the Vatican, the capital there. So there's, and I don't know who the lady is, I just saw the picture. You can get an idea of the scale of the size of this area. So there's the old one that he built. And why do you think he built it there?
Well, it's presumably over the tomb of Peter.
Okay. Okay, so this was a huge problem in some of the early church, if we can still call it the church. They began to venerate all of the apostles and things that they had touched or things that they had kept. So this is a person standing over one of the catacombs, the vents, so that the dead people can breathe, I guess, and get circulation through there. And here is a bronze statue made of Peter. And he's holding a giant key. What do you think that means? And thou art Peter, upon this rock I will build my church and have the keys to Hades and death. This is ridiculous. That's the passage that I think of when Christ said, my kingdom is not of this world. Why are we building these enormous, elaborate churches to worship these people? It's its own state.
It's a country.
Yeah, I think it is its own country. Yeah, it's right in the middle of Rome.
That's the only country in the world, isn't it, that's actually a church country?
I believe. I'm not positive on that. But
I mean, there's church religions, there's state religions, but I mean, they own it. They control it completely.
That's how they have hid all their money and stuff from taxation or anything like that, or from paying out for all of the judgments against them, for all of the crimes they've committed.
I can't think of the name of this altar here. All these things have weird, funny names that I can't really pronounce. Some of them are in Latin. But supposedly Peter's is buried below that big altar there. One of the other significant things that Constantine built was this place. Anybody know what it is?
Don't really care.
It's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So I told you his mother was a Christian, Helena. She took a trip shortly after Constantine became emperor and went down to Jerusalem and was touring Golgotha, Calvary, and looking for the tomb of Christ. And she said that she had found a piece of wood of the true cross that Christ was actually crucified on. And so Constantine went down there and he built this massive church over the grounds of what was both the Hill of Calvary as well as the tomb where they thought that Jesus was buried. Neither was probably the actual spot based on the location outside of the wall of New and Old Jerusalem. But he built this church to encompass both. This is in Jerusalem. Not far from here is the Dome of the Rock that the Muslims have control over, which was the site of the first temple. And the Dome of the Rock sits right on top of what they believe to be the most holy place in the Jewish temple. This is inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre where they believe Christ was entombed. Okay.
I have a question. We see in the Old Testament that the Israelites would have nothing to do with idolatry, with the places where idols were set up, with all this worship, because it was the work of Satan. What difference is there then in what these buildings that you've been showing and all these things that
people have set up that are the work of Satan. So my question is this. What business does a Christian have going to these places and many of them spending money to get in and perpetuate those places? I think it's something we should all think about. Those are not the work of God.
There was a good spot here in Brumback's book that talked about that. Okay, so here's a quote, and it's actually not from Brumback. Brumback's quoting another man, Neander, in the history of the church religion. I thought it was a good comment. He says that we have no authority for paying even to the saints that worship which is due to God alone and which they were ever found to decline. It was a cunning device of Satan to bring back idolatry and under pretext of showing honor to the saints to draw men away from that which is spiritual and to degrade them to that which is sensual. Basically some of the same things that you said there.
They worship buildings, they worship idols, they worship, like you said earlier, the stained glass paintings, the paintings of Michelangelo, all these other things that are physical things, and those are worshipped by many, many people.
Yeah.
And I think we as Christians should, you know, think, does God want us to be in there? I mean, even though we're not worshipping that, what are we doing there?
I'm showing you some images. They're more for an education purpose to try to solidify some of the happenings. I think that some of these things that'll help. Ben?
You know, it's certainly not a belief that would be well tolerated in today's society. But it is very true that this is idolatry. In a very pure sense, it's idolatry with the number of statues and images. And certainly the buildings are also held in high regard. But, you know, people don't see it that way. Because when we read of idolatry, we think, oh, well, you know, you carved up a tree and it's something else. It's not a picture of Jesus or a picture of some other person. But it's still idolatry. And, you know, if you replace that picture of an apostle or a statue of Jesus with a statue of Baal, would you call it idolatry? Well, absolutely. And so, you know, people don't like to hear that, but that's really what this is. We have to be careful, too. You know, we don't have statues and we don't have those things, but we have to be careful about how we spend our time and spend our money and spend our effort, because we know that covetousness is idolatry. And so, you know, we can point out the plank in somebody else's eye, but we've got to be careful to look at the one in our eye too, that we can fall into this same trap too, just in a little different way.
The next thing I wanted to bring out was
Did you read the article by Lewis this week in the Gospel of
Mark? I haven't seen it yet. What's it about?
The article about that Lewis wrote about the, it's called Relics of an Ancient Age or something. It's just reminding you what you're talking about. So he was saying, you know, under the old law, we had many beautiful, tangible, expensive objects that were part of worship, that were part of the temple and even part of the tabernacle, and how the new law, obviously we see these things have gone away. He used the verse, and I can't remember where it's found, but it uses the phrase, so leaving the camp. In other words, leaving that behind, we've gone on to a new law, which is written on our hearts, so we don't need these tangible things for worshiping.
Good point. So good article for everybody to take a look at this week.
So it's not worship. I think, you know, lots of people travel alone, and they look at all that, but I don't think they're thinking anything religious. about that. They never. They just think they're taking a trip and looking at a lot of art.
It could also set the wrong appearance or tone if somebody were. We can have that discussion another time too. But it's a good topic to think about. It's a good thing to bring up and dwell on. Eddie.
I think of it as a historical point. I look at it as Christians suffered there, you know. And like Karen mentioned about Mr. Darby, wrote an article about, you know, how beautiful the temple was, the Jewish temple, and all those. And these men that built these places, Constantine, they were just bringing in the old system to build these beautiful buildings. And so it's a historical point. But there was a lot of Christians that were martyred there.
So
I would look at it as a historical point.
The site of... The site of the old St. Peter's Basilica that Constantine built was on the old grounds of Nero's Circus. So Nero was that terrible emperor around 96 AD that killed so many Christians in his circus. That was the place where the Christians were dying with the animals and with the spear. So that is where St. Peter's Basilica is located, on the site of the murdering of who knows how many Christian martyrs.
One thing before we leave this. We might not all agree with this idea, but I think maybe Lily Ann's point is the most important is if you didn't give it any thought, maybe you need to give it some thought. That's really what it boils down to. Around the end of the year when the people are ringing bells, I don't give money. Right? Well, there's a reason why I don't give money. Maybe you've never thought about that. Well, if you've never thought about it, maybe think about it. Okay? If you've taken a trip, you have an opportunity to go into a Catholic cathedral, and you have to pay money to go in, think about where your money is going and what it's going for. Maybe you still decide to go. But if you've never thought about it, I think that's the important thing. Think about what we do and the statements that we're that our actions are making. I think that's really the bottom line.
Um, 325 was one of the major, the very first councils that Constantine set up. There was a man who was a student, as I said, of Origen. His name was Arian. And he was the one that believed that Christ was a created being, subject and below the Father, much different from the way that we think. So Constantine wanted to bring together, I think it was like 318 bishops from all over the empire together to make some more decisions, kind of like this Council of Elvira, but have more on doctrine and theology in the church. They deliberated for 67 days, all at Constantine's expense. And at the end, Arius and two of his friends were banished, and the Nicene Creed was written to rebuke Arianism. Later on, though, Constantine changed his mind and favored on the side of Arius. So it failed to unite the Christians at that time anyway. Several more councils will be conducted over the year. There were like six or seven, some at Eusebius, some at Chalcedon, and other places. 330 is when Constantine moved the capital from Rome to Byzantium, which they called New Rome, but all the citizens over there wanted to call it Constantinople after Constantine, so they changed its name to Constantinople. Then later we find it changed again to Istanbul, which is in Turkey. 330 was also another big year. So this is when Constantine turns to Eusebius and says, I need you to be in charge of copying 50 codices or copies of the scriptures that they had at that time. There are some people that believe that there are four of those original manuscripts that still survive to today, and they believe that those are the four oldest manuscripts that are in the Greek writing of both some of the Old and New Testament that we have to go on. The Codex Vaticanus, which is still on display in the Vatican. The Codex Sinaiticus, which was, I believe, found around Sinai. There's the Codex Alexandrian, which is down in the library in Egypt, and there's one more that I can't recall the name of, and I don't think I can pronounce it either.
Were these just copies or translations?
These were copies. So they tried to gather up, so they would look to, for example, they would, Eusebius and his scribes at the time would consult with a congregation in Ephesus or Antioch or Thessalonica and basically say, what are the scriptures that everybody is using? And try to get all those together in one document. They were written on vellum, very expensive. They were about 15 by 13, pretty large, written in these columns just like this in the Greek. And he wanted these copies to be kept in Constantinople with him. So here's a picture of Constantine. And down at the bottom, they're working on some of these books. Okay, so that was all that I had on some of those pictures of some of those things to help bring some of this together. We're about done with our class. Constantine dies in 337, and his son takes over. 350 is another major thing that happened in the Catholic Church. It's when the Mass service began, which was interesting. And this is out of Brumback's book. When the sermon ended, those who were not allowed to remain for the Lord's Supper were to leave at the words of the deacon. And he said, I guess in Latin, it missa est, which means you are dismissed. This was the signal that all those unbaptized people could depart without disturbing the service of the Lord's Supper. Later, the phrase was shortened to the Mass and was applied to the Lord's Supper. And so now I think it's just the general term for having service, isn't it? It's not just the Lord's table or the Eucharist, whatever they call it, but it's the entire service. Don't they just call it the Mass? We go to Mass, that's what they say. So that was in 350 that they started basically ushering everybody out and calling it the Mass. 405, Jerome completed the Latin translation of the Bible called the Vulgate. The Old Testament had been in circulation for several hundred years, but the New Testament hadn't been finalized and agreed on quite yet. We had these copies like the ones I was talking about. But Jerome translated it from the Greek to the Latin, the vulgar or the common language of the people that day. 434, Leo I became bishop of Rome and assumed the authority over the churches of the West. And he asserted that Peter was the chief of the apostles and the first bishop of Rome. So that began in 434. And then the last one I had written down is 451, the Council of Chalcedon, which talked about the worship and adoration of Mary. So here's where we're going to go in the next few weeks. We're going to leave Rome and the emperors completely, and we're going to talk about the churches that broke off. And this is kind of the map that we're going to follow. If this is the one true church that Christ established, and in the very beginning we have this falling away with the hierarchy of the elders and deacons being split apart, we have these councils, 325 in Nicaea. There were six or seven of them where they all formed the doctrine of the Catholic Church. All of these came together. And in 325... we talked about that was the split between the Greek Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church. Next week, we're going to talk just a little bit about the Crusades. We're going to talk about people branching off of the Roman Catholic Church. In Brumback's book, there's the Aldenses and the Waldensians that came off first. Shortly thereafter that, in early 1500s, we have the major branches of Protestantism that we're going to talk about next week. The first being Lutheranism from Martin Luther out in Germany. This was around 1511. We've got the Church of England, which became also the Episcopal Church. We've got the Presbyterians. And then down at the end, on the last one that's broken off, is the Baptists. And there's sub-branches of each of these. We'll talk about the beginnings of each of the denominations next week in our class. After we finish some of these talks about the individual denominations, we're going to talk about the restoration movement as well. Thank you.